Hello, ladies and gentlemen. You are listening to Strange Dominions Podcast with your host, Octavian Graves. Tonight, we have a very special guest. His name is Brent Thomas, and he is the host of Paranormal Portal, a podcast and YouTube show. We will be talking about a range of things from Bigfoot, ghosts, aliens, and even his history through podcasting. If you have seen something strange or unusual, such as Bigfoot, ghosts, aliens, fairies, and sea monsters, and anything between, give us an email at strangedominionspodcast@gmail.com. That is strangedominionspodcast@gmail.com. Well, without further ado, let's get into the interview. All right, ladies and gentlemen, tonight we have Brent Thomas on the show. Brent, how you doing?
I'm doing great, man. How you doing?
I'm doing good. I've been looking forward to this for a while because I don't know if you remember, but my first time ever on a podcast was actually on the Paranormal Portal back in 2019.
Wow. Yeah, that's cool. So I obviously corrupted you enough that you decided to start your own, eh?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, that's great, man. I'm honored to be here, and it's a real pleasure to be a part of this. So thank you for inviting me.
No, it's an honor to have you. The first time I think I heard you was on either Wes's show or he was on your show. I can't remember which one, but I know that the Sasquatch Chronicles and Paranormal Portal, that connection was very influential to me when I first started. Because I didn't start listening to podcasts until 2017, 2018.
Oh, okay.
So I'm only 26, but like I was very late to the game on all that. Oh,
dude, to be honest with you, other than Sasquatch Chronicles, I only listened to that one, and I didn't start really hardcore listening to Sasquatch Chronicles until about 2013, and then of course I started my own in I think 2019. This is my third year podcasting. Okay. So yeah. I mean it's. I was late to the game too, to be honest with you. But you know, we can talk about how all this came to be. But yeah, I mean, I would have never guessed that I would have had a podcast. But it's just the way the fates directed it, I guess.
Well, yeah, and I'm really excited to hear how it all started for you, both just in life in general and with the podcast. So you know, wherever you want to start about you know how this all came to be, just go right ahead.
Sure. Well, I mean, honestly, I can't remember a time where I wasn't interested in the paranormal. It's just always been a passion of mine, and I'll get into why in a bit. But I just was always excited by the prospect that there was more to life than just our three dimensions, our you know, label the quantify and label imperatives of sciences and the sterile example of the world that's presented that most people adhere to. For me, it just had to be something more. And so, you know, as a young kid, I was absolutely fascinated with ghosts and with monsters and with creatures and with legends and such. And when I was young, it's quite a long time ago, but I'm much older than 26, but there wasn't an internet, you know, there wasn't this whole online thing that we have readily available to us today. So all of my information came from the very occasional shows that I could catch on television, which were all of three channels. And, you know, so if it didn't happen on those three major networks, it wasn't something that I could have seen. I had no cable. I had, you know, there's no satellite TV back then either. So other than that, it was just the public library and going there and looking at the ghost books. And, you know, it was literally about a 3-foot section of books dealing with all of the paranormal in our local public library because I came from a small town. But I would go in there religiously and just lay on the floor as a young boy, paging through the pages and looking through these stories and imagining this. And quite honestly, I wasn't one of those kids that grew up with a lot of experiences. I had pretty much none that I can remember until I was 14 years old. But I just love this idea that there's still mystery in the world. There were still things that we had yet to learn. There was still discovery. And I still love that. I still love the fact that we don't know it all. And in fact, we probably know very little, even though the hubris of our sciences would suggest, well, you know, this is this and this and this. And, you know, these are the laws of physics, and what you're talking about doesn't adhere to that. So it can't possibly be real. But now, you know, we've come to learn about things like quantum physics, where the laws of physics themselves break down. And, you know, so it lends a lot of possibility and probability to there being a lot of phenomena left in the world that we just don't know about. And so that was my passion always, was to find out as much as I could on this journey of the paranormal. And by paranormal, a lot of people equate that to meaning ghosts. And quite honestly, that's not the case. Paranormal, literally by definition, just means things that aren't normal. So, you know, if your cat suddenly gets up and walks on two legs across the room, that would be paranormal. It's not something it normally does.
For me, it happens all the time. I mean, these cats just cannot cat. They're always walking around and talking. It's really annoying. But sure. I know exactly what you mean, and I agree. And I think that I hope that the term paranormal starts to widen in mm-hmm. the general perception of it, because it's been paranormal means ghosts, phantoms, demons, and spirits from the beginning.
And UFOs and cryptids and anything that's not normal. Yeah.
Right. But in the interesting thing is that there are so many factions within the paranormal that don't want to admit that their niche is paranormal. I mean, there's plenty of people that are diehard Bigfooters, but don't equate that with ghosts to them. Don't talk about UFOs to them with Bigfoot. Sure. You know, and so I can see in a lot of scenarios where, do you ever watch the show Hellier on Amazon?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay. So that's a really good example of how, new theories and new ways of new perspectives on the paranormal are coming through into not necessarily the mainstream, but a wider audience than what has been the generally accepted terminology from before.
Yeah. Greg and Dana Newkirk have been doing a great things with Hellier. That before that, they used to have the News of the Weird or something like that, and that was a
Week
that
and
was
Weird,
a,
I believe.
Week and Weird, yeah. And I loved that site. I loved going there and reading it and such. And they kind of fell away from updating it. I hope they get back to that, because that was fascinating, and I love that. But yeah, the Hellier quest has been incredibly interesting in how it's evolved from what they expected to something completely different. And I think it's been very well done and been very informative. So yeah, I'm with you.
Well, I think the cool thing about Hellier is that it's a demonstration on a phenomena within the paranormal where one question that revolves around the paranormal has so many different branching paths that you don't even realize. I mean, there are so many questions that start out with just about what do you think of ghosts? What do you think of Bigfoot? That go into what is thinking? What is perception? What is consciousness? I mean, it's such an activated topic that can go anywhere, and it brings about, at least it should bring about a much wider discussion.
Yeah, I agree. And that was my quest when I was young, was to learn all that I could about it. You know, unfortunately, there wasn't a lot of things available to me. But, you know, I fell in love with it since then. And, you know, it wasn't until 2016. And you know, it's funny how life brings you on a journey, you know, like you.
Tell some me people. I know exactly what you mean.
Some people start their lives with this real clear vision of what they want, and at a very young age, they work towards that. And that was always, to me, it was really admirable. And I always felt like I was doing something wrong, because I couldn't figure out what it was I was supposed to be doing. And I was always extraordinarily jealous of those people that knew. They just seemed to have this vision, and they worked towards it, and they achieved it. And here I was, this person that was, I didn't fit the norm, you know, and that was never a problem for me in the traditional sense, but it always felt like man, I just feel like a person that has no vision. But I always had a vision, and it was always this. And it wasn't until 2016, I just happened to be working for a company. It was a preparedness company. And one of the gentlemen that was a contractor to the company at the time, it was the owner and creator of Truth Frequency Radio, Chris Geo. And he and I got to be friends, and I knew he had this company and this radio network. And they're fantastic people. Chris and Sheree are wonderful people. And so I said, you know, one time when we were talking, I'm like, you know, I think I want to do a show. He's like, oh, okay. And the funny thing about it was that this idea came to me like a gift, like it was preformed or predestined. And I don't know how else to say it, but as soon as I started talking to him, I was like, I want to call it Paranormal Portal, and I want to do this and this and this. I want to deal with these topics, and I want to, you know, I had this whole idea just kind of spill out of me. Like it was just waiting for me. And it took quite a segment of my life to figure it out. But once I started, I knew that I was home. Like I had finally found my home. I finally found what I wanted to do. And it's become my passion. You know, I love being a dad and a husband and all of those things. Those are wonderful, amazing experiences in my life. But I never had that part of my life where I felt like I was fulfilling those other parts of yourself, you know, where you leave a footprint, you leave some kind of impression in the world, like, hey, I was here and this is mine. And so it just became amazingly fun and cool. And so it was 2016 when I started doing the Paranormal Portal on the Truth Frequency Radio Network. I think it was June. And then Don came on the next year. He was somebody I had on as a guest first. And then he and I just got to be friends. And so I said, you know, you want to come on and be a part of it? And he's like, yeah. So he's been a part of it since pretty early on. But I was doing the show. And then in 2017, I kind of fell in love with the idea of doing streams, you know, and doing YouTube shows. I was like, well, this would be fun, you know, to do live presentations. And I kind of followed Chris Geo into this because his show Beyond the Veil, they were doing an online stream. And so he and I worked together, and he helped me a whole bunch set it up so that I could, you know, get all the, he had all of it sorted out from doing his own show. So he just sat down with me and helped me structure it and schedule it and figure it out. And so therefore the Paranormal Portal on YouTube was born. And it was from there that I was by chance, I got a call one night on my live show, and it was Wes Germer. And I was like, oh my God. Now, prior to that, Tony Merkel had called in from the confessionals, and that was amazing. I was like, you know, Don and I were chatting with Tony Merkel on the show, and I was like, oh my God, this is really cool. And then it was probably about a week later, I answered the phone, and it's like, hey, this is Wes. And I'm like, you're going to be kidding me. It was just this bucket list. Now, I had spent years listening to Wes when I worked in a cubicle doing web pages and HTML and CSS. And I just put on my earbuds and put on Sasquatch Chronicles and went to work for hours. And it was this opportunity to meet someone that I looked up to incredibly. And he called in and we talked on the show and had a great time. And then it was after that he messaged me on Facebook. He says, why isn't this a podcast? I was like, I don't know. Like, it had never occurred to me that the Paranormal Portal should be a podcast. And so I was like, I don't know. And so, you know, he talked with me and I decided, okay, it's going to be a podcast. And he was a great mentor to me in developing that. So I've been very, very blessed and fortunate to have all of these incredible people show up at just the right time to help me to bring the show to another level. So I've been incredibly fortunate. And every one of these people that I'm mentioning have been absolutely selfless and helpful and have extended themselves to such an amazing degree for me to make this show happen. So I am the product of I guess a lot of serendipity and some pretty incredible people.
Well, that's really, you know, that's such a great story, especially because I, you know, what you were saying about coming home and this feeling like the thing you were meant to do. I had that same feeling. And I think a lot of people who are into the weird, paranormal, supernatural, anything within that field, it has a way, if you have an interest in it, it, I don't know if it calls to you or if it summons you. I don't know what the right word is, but it's something that, at least for me, you know, I've been into it since I was a little kid. I mean, and I had kind of a weird upbringing because my grandmother, she was an astrologer for years and years and years, and she was into all kinds of stuff. And I don't know if you know the illustrator and author Edward Gorey.
No, I'm not familiar with
him. Okay, well, he was an illustrator and writer back in the, like, I think he started in the 1950s and he died in the 1990s, but he had a very macabre sense of humor and dark sense of humor, and his drawings are very, very specific. He's most famous for a work called The Ghastly Crumb Tinies, and it's an alphabet book. You know, A is for something, B is for something, but it's children dying. You know, A is for Amy who fell down the stairs, B is for Basil who's eaten by bears, and it's, you know, children being killed in these horrible ways as a children's book. And my grandmother read that to me as a child, and it just kind of, I don't know, I was already weird, and she just pushed me more into it. And when I decided to do this, I started out wanting to do film, and I still kind of want to do that, but I always wanted to do kind of like what the I don't know if you know Small Town Monsters.
Seth Breedlove. Yeah.
Oh yeah. So that before that was even a thing, that was something that I really wanted to do. But as I started going to school and talking to people within the film world, the general consensus was that's not going to fly. The public's not going to be into that. You're not going to make any money doing that. You need to, you know, quell those expectations. And I was like, well, I can't do that. I can't not do that. And so I kind of lost interest in film. And then I found out about podcasts, and Wes Germer and Sasquatch Chronicles was probably the first one that I ever listened to. And then I found you and Tony Merkel and a couple others. And the thing that made me want to do a podcast was I would listen to these shows and I would always think, you know, this is a great show, but I really wish the guest or the host had asked this question or that question, or they were so close to this one topic, but they didn't quite get there. And if I had a show, but there were a lot of things in my childhood that pushed me to this. I mean, besides being into Bigfoot, ghosts, aliens, I had a strong interest in the occult, and then that went into heavy metal. And I remember having an idea for a band about cryptids, because apparently no one had ever done that before. And so it's kind of been one of those things that I don't think I could have gotten away from. I think it was always something that was supposed to be a very central part of my existence. So I really resonate with everything you were saying about all of, you know, how you came up in it.
Yeah. And it becomes a journey of itself. And I would just say, you know, there are a ton of podcasts out there. There are hundreds and thousands of them. And thousands of them that deal with this topic area, but and this is going to sound creepy, and I really don't mean it that way, because I think that people are doing it because it's something they enjoy and love, and I think that's awesome. But there's a lot of people that are really kind of phoning it in, and they're not putting the value into it that they could or should. You know, I think there are those people that get into this because they think it's a quick buck, you know, like, well, I'm going to have a podcast too, because, you know, that's a way to make quick money. But it really isn't. It's a lot of work. There's a lot that goes into this.
And not a lot of payoff from everything I've heard.
Right. I mean, you've got to work. You've got to work to get into the opportunities to make money from it. So a lot of times you're donating your time. But if you're building towards something, it can become wonderful, you know. And so I think that that's both the good and the bad. I mean, it's good to have a lot of voices in this arena, because I think the more people talk about it, the more it's going to help the subject move forward. But I think that a lot of people get disillusioned with the fact that, well, wait, I got a podcast. Where's the money now? You know, and it's really, it's gotta be, you know, something that you build and that you work at and put energy into and make it, the best you can possibly make it. And then I think that those other parts come, but I'm not bad mouthing anybody by saying that.
I understand exactly what you mean, because, you know, what you were saying about, you know, Wes Germer helping you and, the people from the radio show, mm-hmm. I'm super envious, because when I started this back in, I recorded the first episode back in September of 2021. Mm-hmm. I'm doing it entirely by myself. I don't have anyone controlling the gears for me. I don't have anyone, you know, over my shoulder. I'm doing it completely on my own, just trying to pick up from the podcasts that I listen to and sure. trying to ask as many questions and not be annoying to the people that I look up to in this field.
Sure.
But it's both incredibly stressful and incredibly enjoyable to be able to figure something out completely on your own without any help. And, but it would be nice if I had someone like Wes Germer kind of explaining to me the ins and outs and what, works and what doesn't work.
Well, I'm here for you, brother. Whatever.
I appreciate that. And I know, and I've asked you a couple questions and you've been a great resource to me, and I really appreciate that.
Oh, absolutely. It's my pleasure, because I can only, since I had, you know, so many wonderful people step forward and help me, that's kind of the pay it forward scheme, right? So I figure it's incumbent upon me to be there for people as well and to help where I can. And I'm happy to do that, because certainly my show wouldn't be where it is without the help of so many people. And likewise, I hope to perpetuate that for others as well. And that really surprised me about it. I know this isn't necessarily a show about podcasts, but I think it's kind of a neat takeaway, is that when I got into this, I thought, I'm going to have to be really competitive. I'm going to have to be competing against other shows. I'm going to have to, you know, crawl over the bodies of my enemies. And, then to find out, no, it wasn't like that at all. I had people bending over to help me and to assist me. And so I was really super thrilled about that, because, you know, nobody wants to go to battle. Nobody wants to fight for, you know, something. And that wasn't my experience at all. And I'm not saying it doesn't exist. I'm sure and know that it does, because, you know, no matter what you do, there's going to be somebody throwing stones. But the people that I've managed that have managed to find me for whatever reason have been nothing but helpful and supportive and wonderful. And so the least I can do is to try to be there for those people that reach out to me and say, hey, you know, I want to do this too. And I don't know that I'm any kind of expert, but I've been at it a while, and I can at least help you avoid the pitfalls that I managed to stumble into. So,
well, what I both value academic knowledge, but also experiential knowledge, and I really appreciate that, because I know you've been in it for a while, and mm-hmm. you know, you've been through the ringer, and you know, you've experienced a lot with this podcast, and so I value your word just as I do anyone else's. The help that you have given me and all the advice and the things that we've talked about, it has definitely gone to my heart, and I really appreciate everything you've told me about. Go ahead.
I said I'm glad. I mean, that means a lot, because, you know, I really do hope to help you as you're, you know, building this dream as well.
I appreciate that. And, you know, if there's anything I can do to help you, I'm more than happy to.
I think this is a big part too, because just talking and networking and getting involved in other shows and creating relationships, I think, is really powerful, you know?
Oh no, I absolutely agree. Especially in this field, because the paranormal it's unlike anything else in the sense that it's, at least it should be acknowledged, that there are no experts. there are no aficionados. There's people that have been in it a long time and have experienced a lot of it, but there's no one that has a degree in cryptozoology. You know, and so it's always good to be able to find someone that understands that, like, yes, they have been in it for a long time, and there's a lot that they can teach you, but they don't know everything either. They're still learning stuff and figuring it out, especially in this field, because the thing that I've always had an issue with is the idea is the people that come into it, and I think that it's natural to start out this way, but I'm always wary of people who've been in it for a long time and still believe this, that when they get into it, they're going to be the one that finds Bigfoot. They're going to be the one that proves ghosts exist. They're going to be the one that shows science that there's life after death. And I can't. There's no way for me to rationally get on board with that, at least for myself, because it's been, I mean, just with Bigfoot, we've been in this since, well, the 50s, but I mean, they've been seen and heard and experienced forever. And what what's the best we have? We have a footprint and 60 millimeter film. So, you know, it's always interesting when I see people who their goal in it isn't so much to experience it. It's more to get some kind of result out of it.
Right.
And I don't know how someone who's in it for a long time can keep that mindset, who allows themselves to believe that after all this time that they're going to be the one that, that gets into it. And I think for me, that would ruin it. Like, if I really believed that, after a while, I would get so burned out and just have to put it down and move on to something else.
I think that's true too. And the one thing, you know, again, I would have to absolutely agree that there are no experts. There's plenty of people that will wear that mantle proudly and proclaim themselves experts, but really, I mean, you're right. What empirical evidence do we have? Well, very, very, very little. If any, I mean, most of it's anecdotal. There's some casts of footprints, which I think, you know, personally, I think those are incredibly compelling, especially if they've been examined by someone like Jeff Meldrum, Dr. Jeff Meldrum, who is understands the physiology of the foot and can comment on what he sees and show that it's not just a cutout. And, you know, but there aren't a whole lot of things to really justify it other than a lot of sightings and experiences. But the thing that I think you're right also about is that no one person is going to solve this. It's going to be a collection. But the one thing that seems clear is that it's going to be people like you and I and the people that go out there and research and that are going to crack these things open. It's not going to be our official sciences and stuff, because they don't expend any resources on it for whatever reason. And I don't pretend to know why they won't look into the phenomena, but clearly with the amount of people coming forward with claims and the amount of evidences that have been able to be collected, there seems to be enough to at least warrant some official attention, but still they don't want to do it for whatever reasons. And I'm not going to get into conspiracies and why, or, you know, if it's the logging industry or government cover-ups or whatever. I mean, I don't pretend
Bigfoot conspiracies, but no, I understand that point of view.
But I mean, we just don't know. And you know, anybody that says, well, I know this is why, because, you know, I have an insider. Well, you may be right. You may be full of crap. It's hard to know. But all we do know is that there are experiences. People are seeing something that doesn't line up with our traditional understandings of our natural world, whether it's ghosts, whether it's UFOs, whether it's, you know, cryptids or other strange phenomena, like, you know, potentially people, you know, going through wormholes or portals of some kind and ending up in different time periods or different geographical areas than what they were. You know, I mean, there's so much phenomena that people are experiencing. And that's what I love about the paranormal, the whole umbrella of it, because I don't want to live in a world that doesn't have Discovery, as I stated before, but I think the paranormal is not where reality is hiccuping or there's glitches in the matrix, quote unquote. I think that the paranormal is demonstrating the true nature of the reality we live in. It's the breadcrumbs. It's demonstrating that we have a lot to learn because things like this are happening. And if you take away 99.9% of all of the claims out there, and if you were to remove that many and just say, I'm only going to believe 0.1% of the claims out there.
That's still really weird.
That still demonstrates something going on that shatters our traditional understandings of the world around us. And so, and they all can't be wrong. They all can't be lying. I mean, they all can't be
statistically speaking, it would be impossible for them to be lying. And, you know, I've heard people say, oh, well, they're imagining it. They're hallucinating. Well, if you're hallucinating, if that many people are hallucinating that often, then there's something equally as weird going on. I don't know if it's the water, but you know, I don't really buy there that it could be a very, very small selection of the cases that could be an answer. Obviously misidentification is a thing, but I was in a discussion board a couple weeks ago, and it was in a Bigfoot group, and they were talking about bears and how many people see bears and think it's Bigfoot. And when it was a video, and I watched the video, and the first thing I noticed was how short the arms are on the bear walking on 2 feet. And every Bigfoot account I've heard is one of the first things they notice is how long the arms are. And so that just kind of takes that out of the hat right away.
Sure.
And so, I think that there's a lot of theories that all kind of meld into each other that are a possibility with this. Mm-hmm. I definitely don't think it's going to come down to one answer or one explanation. I think it's going to be a vast amount of different perspectives and different ways of looking at it that's going to, and I don't think we'll ever solve it, but I think we'll begin to understand it a little bit better, and more importantly, how it relates to us and what our place is in it. But Brent, what I wanted to ask you was, I know that you've had some experiences of your own.
Yes, I've had several. The first experience that I alluded to before was when I was 14, and that's the first one I can recall. And I don't know that I ever had anything else happen prior to that. I've thought about it many times, but, and I can remember getting my diaper changed as a little infant. So, I mean, my memory goes way back, and I don't remember anything before this 14-year-old mark. And I don't know why. I mean, it's just, I guess either I missed a lot of things prior to that or they just didn't happen. But at any case, what was going on was I currently live in the north tip of Idaho, but at the time when I was growing up, and I'm a Minnesota native, so I grew up in southeastern Minnesota, right along the Mississippi River, in the river valley there. And what happened was I grew up in the woods. Like we lived in a very rural area and right next to a state park, a state reserve. And so I used to spend all my time in the woods when I was young. I just loved the woods and, you know, ran through these woods all, you know, since I was a, you know, smaller child to, you know, up into my teen years anyway. And it was when I was 14 years old and I didn't have a lot of friends, just simply because there weren't a lot of kids living anywhere near me. In school, I was, you know, social and fine, but, just when it came to, you know, during summer times, however, one kid would always come down and stay at his great aunt and uncle's place. And, he became my best friend. And he and I were hiking up in this bluff. And I don't know if you're familiar with the term bluff, but, that's like a mountain with a rounded top, not as high elevation and stuff. But we in the river valley there were, you had these bluffs all over, and the bluff that I'm speaking of was called Rattlesnake Bluff. And he and I went for a hike up to the top of the bluff. It was kind of our, you know, every year we would do it a bunch of times, and this is just another trip up the bluff. And so we went and hiked up this bluff, which is also part of the state forest. And we got up to the top and we're up there all day long looking around and having, you know, having a good time. I mean, we were not troublesome kids. We were just, you know, nature kids, I guess. So we got later in the day and we're like, we better head down because it's going to get late. And you don't want to be stuck on the bluff coming down this forest in the dark of night because it's out in the country. There's no ambient light unless the moon's out. And even then, it can be treacherous. So we start heading down in the afternoon and we got probably about halfway down this dry run. It's like a ravine that runs the length down the bluff to the Mississippi River, but it's a dry run because it's only flowing with water during the spring melt off and stuff. So it was absolutely dry, but we're coming down this ravine going down and we stop at this waterfall section. It's about an 8 foot drop or whatever, right in front of us and down to, you know, more rocks and stuff. And we just kind of stopped to take a break. So we're just stopped and we're standing there. And suddenly from right behind us, and I mean within feet, I don't know how many feet, but right behind us comes this low, deep, foreboding growl. And it was so resonant and deep that it vibrated my body. And I grew up in these woods, as I stated, and I knew these woods as well as I knew my backyard. It was just like it was part of my life. And the biggest thing we had was white-tailed deer. This is an area that had raccoons, maybe some coyotes. Perhaps, you know, there could be like there was never any bear even reported around here. It was just nothing. But here was this dark growling. And it was so powerful that it actually was vibrating me. And I froze. And a lot of people talk about how I couldn't move. I was frozen. Well, I could have moved. I just didn't dare move because whatever it was about 8 feet behind me and taller than me by a good bunch. You know, like at the time I was probably about 5'4", and whatever this was way higher up than me. And it was just growling and it just freaked us out. And so I didn't dare move because whatever was making the sound, I was convinced was about to kill me. So I didn't want to see it. I did not want to see what that thing looked like. That was my one takeaway. It was like, if I'm going to die here, I'm not going to see what it looked like. So, you know, I was just terrified, but finally it just continued growling. Nothing changed for several seconds. So I was like, what is that to my friend? And he goes, I don't know, but we got to get out of here. And, you know, you always hear people say, well, if you know, you're ever in a situation like that, don't run because you don't want to trigger a predatory response. But I mean, you got two options. It's fight or flight. Whatever was making that noise, I was sure was way out of my fight range. So the only thing left was to run, to, you know, get out of there. And that's what we did. We took off and we ran. And whatever it was didn't follow us. I mean, it was just whatever it was just stayed where it was, I guess, because we ran the last, you know, 3/4 of a mile or a mile down and got to the road and hurriedly got home and that was it. And so I had no reference for this for my entire, you know, young life. I didn't know anything about it. I mean, I can't say I didn't.
So this happened before you like started reading books on it?
No, I did know of a thing called Bigfoot, but I did know that Bigfoot was in the Pacific Northwest. And at the time, that was the only real correlation I ever heard about it, was that it was this creature in the Pacific Northwest. So, you know, Washington, Oregon, California. But not in Minnesota. So like I have no reference for what this could be. And so I just carried it in the back of my mind as this unsolved, weird, incredibly terrifying situation. It was one of the, if not the most terrified I've ever been in my life. I was absolutely sure that was my last moments. I mean, whatever it was so big and so powerful and so absolutely thoroughly intimidating that I didn't know what to do. And the only option was to run. So we ran. And so I carried this around for years. I mean, I used to watch like In Search Of with Leonard Nimoy, and that's where I primarily heard about Bigfoot.
I think a lot of people did. I don't know if I've ever listened to, especially on Sasquatch Chronicles, someone say that they got into this without watching that in their childhood at least once. So I was sure. Kind of expecting you to say that.
Yeah, I mean, that was, it was my experience. I mean, that was the one show back in that time that really dealt with all this unknown phenomena that was on TV. So, you know, that was about it in the, at that era of my life. So I didn't know what it was, but it was something big and growling. And I knew about Bigfoot again, but it was a situation of something in the Pacific Northwest. So I carried that around for decades, and it wasn't until I just kept wondering what could make a sound like that. That would be here. What could do that? And there's nothing in the local fauna that should have been able to make that sound, as far as I knew. I mean, we had deer, coyote, we had raccoons, fox, you know, anything on the smaller size, but nothing big enough to make that sound. Even if it was a black bear, it was so much bigger than that. It was just, it's hard to explain what that feels like to be so close to a sound like that, but it's absolutely emasculating. I mean, I just felt like an infant. And so I carried that around for years, and it wasn't until I was in my, maybe my 40s that I started learning about Sasquatch and about Bigfoot and about the signs that are attributed to them and things that people observe that they believe is caused by Bigfoot. So I went back up into those hills in my later adult life. And I was doing actually a photo shoot for a preparedness company I worked for. I worked for them and I telecommuted and stuff. So I also did some photography. So I took some products out into those woods, started taking photos. And as I'm taking photos, I had a feeling I got to go up higher on the hill. There's something, I don't know, something about an area up there was really compelling to me. Just one of those things. I have no idea why. But I started looking around as I went up there, and I started to see the signs that people attribute to these Bigfoot, Sasquatch. And one big one was seeing a 6-inch sapling, like a maple sapling, snapped off about 4 feet up with no deadfall on it. Something broke a sapling in a forest with nothing that had fallen on it to break it. And so, I mean, there's no snow load that would have done that in Minnesota. Nothing of the sort. So it was that was a big one. And then going up past this, there was a bunch of huge limestone boulders that had naturally fallen off the bluff, you know, eons ago, probably. But they kind of created a barrier halfway up the side of the bluff. And I walked past that. And that's when I saw a structure. And it wasn't the big teepee structures that people talk about. It was actually more like the hill was dug out a bit under it. But so it was like almost like a survival shelter, but it was made completely with broken wood. There wasn't a cut in any of the pieces. It was like these sticks and logs were all positioned in such a way as to make this low-ceilinged shelter. And I found that, and I found a little maple sapling branch about an inch in diameter that was stripped of its bark, and it was still tacky to the touch. Now, there's nothing that I know of in Minnesota that should be like grabbing sapling branches and taking that tender bark off. But I don't know. And immediately when I found that, I was like, oh my God, thinking about like gorillas, you know, how they break off the young, and they'll peel off the bark and chew on that. And it made me think, oh, you know, could that have been something that they were snacking on? So I started to find signs of it. So I can't say that I saw Bigfoot. I can't say for sure that I had a Bigfoot encounter, but the only thing I can think of with all of those points is that it must have been a Bigfoot.
It's interesting because Minnesota is a lot bigger and has a lot more forested areas than where I am in Maryland. But there are still a pretty numerous amount of Bigfoot cases in Maryland, not just in the western part, which is where the mountains and dense forests are, but we're talking areas near Baltimore, near DC, where it's heavily developed and was back when the accounts were taken. And I've gone into the woods around here, and while I've never seen anything, I have heard things that, you know, get attributed to Bigfoot. So I've heard the wood knocks, I've heard some growling and some like grunts, and I've had some experiences with that, and I think it's interesting how many people, and for so long, believed and had this idea that A, there's only one of them, and B, they only live in Washington State and Oregon.
Right.
I've always wondered, because I believed that when I was a little kid. I thought, you know, I wanted to go to Washington when I was 8 years old, specifically to go and try and find a Bigfoot or have an encounter.
Right.
And then when I was probably 17 or 18, I started looking on the earlier than that, because whenever Finding Bigfoot came out, I learned about the BFRO, and I got on their website, and I started looking around Maryland, and I'll be damned, there's 10, 20 different sightings in these areas that I've been to and are neighborhoods, essentially.
Right. Yeah.
And so it's very interesting the just where these kind of experiences can happen.
Oh, absolutely. But
that's a crazy encounter. You know, I've never heard anything quite like that, but I can't really imagine what I would have done in your situation. I mean, I think I would have probably felt the same way about, you know, I could run, but I really, really don't want to.
Yeah, I didn't want to either, but I didn't want to die either. And so as far as I knew, not knowing what it could be, not knowing anything about it, but just knowing there was some rumbling noise of something that was not happy to see me. And I was just thinking, well, the only thing left is just to run, because that's the only option available. So I think it's amazing to people to find out how absolutely diverse their habitat could be. I mean, this is a global phenomenon. This is not just in America.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there's, you know, Indonesia and China and Russia, and Australia. I don't know if there's an area that has not had one iteration of a giant, hairy, wild beast, man beast, in their folklore, at least.
Right. The only one that I know of, the only state in the U.S. that doesn't have a claim, any claims at all, as far as I know of, is Hawaii.
Heard that, but apparently I haven't read the article, but there has been a sighting. Now, I don't know if it's been substantiated or investigated, but apparently in the more remote area of one of the islands, there has been something similar to a Bigfoot seen by, I think it was a hiker or like an out-of-towner, not a native.
It could be. I mean, anything's possible. Like there's some people that speculate that they might utilize extinct lava tubes to transverse different areas of the world. And maybe that's true. Maybe that's possible, but I find that unlikely, but I'll never say that something isn't possible, because I guess one of the things I've learned the most since doing this show is that anything's possible. The minute you say something's not possible, someone will, you know, tell you about something they experienced where, you know. And if you always have the ability not to believe people, but I generally give people the benefit of the doubt, because, you know, I mean, after a while you get kind of good at weeding out the BS and stuff. And at least I believe so. I could be wrong, of course, but, you know, I think generally when people say, you know, that are sitting to me in a very emotional way, talking about things they've experienced, I don't take that away from them. Who am I to say? But that, and just covering different phenomena and talking, reading different articles on the shows and stuff, it's like, yeah, I mean, if you can think it, there's a claim of it somewhere.
Oh, no, I agree. Going back to the account you had when you were a kid, do you think, did you ever go back into those specific woods after that incident?
It took me, after this incident, it took me actually like a couple of years to go back into there. I did go back in. Yeah. I mean, I did because I figured, well, you know, I'd been up there so many years throughout my life prior to that, never having an experience. And then when I started going back up there after that, I never had an experience like that. But I just think what I think is that they may not be there all of the time. I don't think that they're necessarily migratory, but I think they probably have a pretty wide range. That is their home range. And it could be like, you know, hundreds of miles, you know, it may be. And I think that perhaps they may cycle through part of, you know, different parts of their habitat at different times. Like the area that I saw them in wasn't like miles and miles, you know, in any direction of unadulterated forest. There was quite a bit of forest, but it was more in a stretch along the river valley. So could that be their range? Yeah, that could be. But, you know, I grew up in those areas and never had any other experience prior to that of, you know, weird things happening. So I think about it. It's like, well, maybe they're only there during a specific time. And that just happened to be the time when we took this walk. Maybe they travel through this bottleneck to one of their other parts of their range, you know, and maybe that only happens certain times of the year. But I will tell you that about, you know, for the most part, I've always felt really at home in those woods. But I don't know, it was about 9 years ago, 10 years ago. And suddenly I felt like a shift where the forest felt less friendly. And I don't know what that's all about either, but that's more of a intuitive thing, I guess, than anything. It's like, I don't know, something changed for me. And maybe it's because they're settling there more often. But I do think that the one thing that I really think that all of these reports about Bigfoot and the like demonstrate is how absolutely successful these things are. Like they are the most successful organism on the planet, bar none. Nothing else comes close. They can be in any habitat, whether it's jungle, whether it's desert, whether it's mountains, whether it's plains, and everything in between, swamps. And nothing else is as diverse in their habitat as this. And I've had people say, well, people. And I was like, no. People
are very fragile. I mean, we can go to certain areas, but only for a limited amount of time. We can't live out there.
Well, what we do is we go to an area and we create our comfort. Exactly. Like we put up houses, we put in heaters, and, you know, so we can create our comfort anywhere, which is, you know, maybe no less impressive, but it's not the same thing at all.
One of the theories that, you know, when I've had this discussion, because mm-hmm. my friends, they entertain me in my fascination with all this stuff, but they certainly, like, they're very analytical, empirical. If science doesn't believe in it or does not give it credence, then neither do they. And so they'll kind of grill me on it. And so I had kind of come up with this theory about when we were monkeys and we dropped out of the trees, we weren't going to survive like we had when we had the upper hand and we were in the trees. So we had to kind of recreate the environment to suit us. But if these things are, I mean, very clearly, they're very intelligent. So with their, you know, when they decided at some point just to stay in the woods and stay away from people and not build a civilization like us, I have this theory that can heighten senses and allow you that they're very natural, but when you become civilized, you lose them. And I don't really know how to like flesh out that theory. But I've always felt that if a species was intelligent and they adapted to the natural world, then they might possess certain abilities that are totally natural, but to us seem very unnatural and supernatural because we divorced ourselves from nature as a whole so long ago that we just don't have access to those abilities anymore. And that's just a theory. I mean, that's just me. But I see a lot of things about people who, you know, spend all their lives in the woods, in the mountains, and they seem to just be different in a lot of ways. They're not that they're superheroes or anything, but they seem to have more heightened senses, certain abilities that are just a bit more than most people who spend their lives in civilization.
Sure. Yeah. And then there's, the environmental awareness as well. Like, you know, a woodsman will know what sounds mean, but somebody coming into it from the city wouldn't have any clue. Everything sounds foreign. Okay. And so there's that as well. But yeah, no, I agree. I think that, you know, once you build your comforts, you end up losing whatever it was that allowed you to subsist before that. And so, Yeah, I'm sure we've artificially modified ourselves just by our lifestyles and generational living and heat and the normal comforts that we have in our modern days. So we don't ever have to be too hot because we can turn on an air conditioner, and we don't ever have to be too cold because we can turn on a heater. And, you know, so we don't ever have to struggle for food because we can just go to a store. And so we never get that, you know, the boosts of fasting and stuff naturally. We have to artificially do it. And so I think there's a lot of things that would have naturally occurred for us and probably made us more physically robust that have fallen away just because of our ability to create our comfort.
Exactly. And there's a lot of evidence that spending time out in nature, it kind of, you know, it brings you back to a certain state that is really good for mental health and physical health. You know, I think in Europe, they prescribe tree time, which is just going out and spending time in the woods, because it reconnects you with, you know, the earth and your ancestors and things like that. But just being out in the environment and being in that surrounding and feeling that air, it just does something to our lungs and to our whole existence, really, that we, if you don't do, you know, we can be very deprived of it, and it begins to show itself more and more the less time you spend out there.
Yep. I think that's absolutely right. Very good points.
One question I wanted to ask you was, you said that when you went out in the woods that one time, it felt dark or just not positive. Have you felt that before or after that?
Yeah, just since then, it's like something shifted. And I don't know whether it was something that shifted in me, just maybe it's part of being older and not as adept at taking care of myself as I once was, but it's anybody's guess. But it really feels more energetic, like there's a shift, just a change. And suddenly those woods didn't feel quite so comfy anymore. And I really don't know what to make of it. I couldn't begin to tell you, but it's just, I tend to be empathic in a sense that I just get vibes, you know, whatever that means to all of you out there listening, then, you know, I guess that's what it means to you. But, I don't know, it's just like something shifted, something changed. And it was really kind of sudden, like, whoa, you know, almost like you know, with the Mandela effects where people theorize that you just slid into a different dimension. It feels like that. It's just like, pow, wow, this doesn't feel quite the same. Now, I live in the north of Idaho, and up here, you know, the forests are a whole lot different. They're even, you know, more intimidating because up here you're on the menu. And that's pretty freaky. But, you know, and my wife and I like to go out and mushroom hunt and stuff like that. So it's not that I avoid the woods at any regard, but it's just, I don't know, I have a different respect for them now, where I used to be carefree. And now I feel like, you know, even back in Minnesota, like, I don't know. I just feel like I got to look over my shoulder a little more.
Well, I think there's something about when someone experiences, not just Bigfoot, but anything within the paranormal field, it kind of feels like, I don't want to say that you're given certain abilities, but it's kind of like your consciousness is elevated just a tad, and it stays there. And you're not the same. And all of a sudden you have a stronger, intuition. You have a stronger ability to, feel and pick up on your surroundings, that a lot of people who have not had these kind of experiences, it just doesn't really occur to them. And it may not have occurred to the people that experienced it before they experienced it. But once they did, you know, they talk about it. So many people say, like, you know, I'm just not the same. Like it changed me. Well, that change may not necessarily be bad for you. I mean, if it allows you to be more aware of your surroundings, especially in some place like Idaho, where there's bears, there's cougars, there's wolves, then as far as I can tell, at least, it may not feel good, but it's only to your betterment.
Yeah, I think that's probably true. I mean, Lord knows I've not seen a bear close up since I've been here. I've had seen several moose, and they can be plenty dangerous too. In fact,
those moose, they can be diabolical.
yeah, they kill more people every year than bear, actually. So they're by far the more dangerous of them. Bears just tend to avoid people for the most part. But I have seen a bear cub once, kind of close, but that made me a little nervous.
Well,
because
yeah, that's almost more dangerous than seeing the full grown one, because you know they're around somewhere.
Yeah, the mom's around somewhere, and I didn't know where. So, you know, it was off of a road, so I was close to a car. So I didn't really feel real scared of that, but I was very cognizant of the fact that there's a young bear, and somewhere around here is the mom. And I think the mom was off into a forest off to the side. It was one of the power line draws, you know, that go up a mountain, and there was a cub out there, a grizzly cub. And I saw it. It came out of the woods and then was messing around and started going towards the bull moose. And suddenly the mom must have called it, because all of a sudden it looked back at the forest and then took off back to the forest. But it was like, oh, man, that I didn't know if I was going to watch a little cub get mauled or beat on, or if the mom was going to come out and go toe-to-toe with the moose, or what was going to go on. But
it could have gone so many different ways. I would have almost been kind of interested just to see what the outcome of that would have been.
Right. Yeah. Well, apparently the mom called it back, because then the little cub went back to the forest off to the side. But yeah, there's a lot up here. I think you're right about what you said about, you know, these experiences definitely changing you. And I agree. I think that, you know, certainly we hear about those things all the time, and like hauntings and stuff, that people tend to develop more of a psychic awareness. I think if you're a follower even of Ghost Adventures, like when that came out, Zach and
I used to be a big fan of that show, but I don't know. There's something about Zach that over time has just, I don't know. I always get a weird feeling about him.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, he's definitely got an attitude about what he does, but you know, fantastic. They've been extraordinarily successful doing what they do, but, you know, when they first started out, they were just, you know, a bunch of guys looking for stuff. But I think that through the years of them doing it, they do develop a psychic sensitivity to the energies and stuff, because, you know, you never used to hear them talking about, oh, you know, look at the hair, you know, the bumps raised up in my arm. And then more and more through the years, as you watch it, they were starting to become more and more sensitive to when, you know, something was wrong or something had changed. And I think you know, having had many ghost experiences myself, I think that you just kind of develop an awareness when that energy shifts and when it's present. I think, I don't know if that's exclusively the case, but I believe I tend to feel when you're in an area of heightened energy like that.
Well, I know we're getting a little short on time, but if you want to talk about some of your ghost experiences, I would love to hear them.
Yeah, they're mostly bit kind of like piecemeal, like, and you know, in this place something happened, and then in this place something happened. I mean, there was a couple of times that I've actually seen an orb with my own eyes, like not through a photograph or a movie, but right in front of my face. I was sitting on I was back in Minnesota at the time, and I was sitting on the in front of the couch on the carpet, and then back at this time I used to smoke cigarettes, and I was smoking a cigarette, and it was night. My ex-wife was sleeping at the time, and I was sitting there just watching television. I was always a night owl, so I was up late. And I'm sitting there, and suddenly, about a foot and a half away from my nose, is this little yellow ball of light drifting slowly by my face. And I was like, wow. I was like, this is amazing. What is this? And at this time, I didn't really have much of a concept of this is a spirit orb. Because I'd not really heard much about spirit orbs, you know, this was kind of before I dove into, you know, really, really researching this stuff. So I just saw this little ball of light. It looked like a ball, like a little mini sun about the size of a quarter. And it was just drifting in front of my face. And it wasn't as bright as the sun. So it was like, it just looked like a pretty ball of light. And I was like, huh. I was like, should I grab that? And then I thought to myself, I don't even know what this is. I should not be grabbing it. So I didn't. And it just kind of drifted by and then just, you know, kind of went around me and disappeared. And I never saw it again. Now, I saw the second one of those in this house where I'm at in the north of Idaho. I woke up one morning and pretty much, you know, I'm a slow riser. But I woke up and the first thing I'm thinking of when I get up is coffee.
Yeah, so, the same way.
So I was making my way to the kitchen, and I'm coming into the kitchen, and the kitchen's kind of L-shaped where there's like cupboards along the floor and that dog legs to the left as you're walking into it. And I was just walking into the kitchen, and around that cupboard, about a foot or foot and a half off the floor, is another one of those yellow balls of light. And it comes around the cupboard and then goes right in front of my legs and then goes around. And I was like, huh. Now, I can't say that I couldn't be scared. So I don't ever want to put that out to the universe to challenge it. But I normally, in the other experiences that I'll talk about in a minute, but I none of them scared me. Like, never have I been terrified. There's only one time that it freaked me out. But in those orb situations, like, oh, there's another one of those lights. But this time I knew what it was, of course. And I was like, well, I knew this house has some activity. And there's, you know, I could tell ghost stories for another 2 hours of things that I've experienced. But some of the big ones, as I lived in an old house that I used to own. It was built in 1894. It was a Queen Anne Victorian home back in Red Wing, Minnesota. And I was there was activity in this house on and off, but it was mostly in certain times of the year. But it was after my first wife and I split up, and I was, you know, all alone in this house. And like she had, she took half the stuff as usual. So my dining room didn't have any furniture in it. But we had had activity in this house for years here and there, like doors opening, you know, and like a one of those kitchen doors that goes both ways.
Yeah, we actually have one of those in my house.
Yeah, so it would kind of close and open, like flop by itself every once in a while. But I was walking through the dining room to the doorway, which is right past it, to go out of the house. I was leaving. But as I walked through the dining room, I got to the door. And suddenly had this feeling like I had to turn around. So I did. And I turned around and looked back to the dining room I just walked through. And from the ceiling was this old cheap chandelier. And it pulled out of the ceiling and crashed onto the floor. And I mean pulled out of the ceiling, like pulled the plaster with it, you know. And so it like literally came down. And it was like something said, here, watch this, you know. And so I felt like I had to turn around. I did. Watched it crash on the floor. Now, honest to God, and I don't know if there's something wrong with me or not, but the only thought I had was, oh, damn it, now I got to fix that, you know?
No, there's nothing wrong with you, because I had an experience a couple years ago with what I guess one could call a poltergeist type activity, where I was at I was staying in a friend's house, and it was an old house from like the 1920s. I don't know what the history of it was about, you know, if anyone died in it or anything, but I was sitting on the counter, and mm-hmm. there was a glass cup across the, you know, the counter was like a U shape.
Okay.
That makes sense. So the sink was in the middle, and then you had, you know, more counter on either side. And I was sitting on the counter waiting for my friend, because we were going to go out. I don't know. I think we were going to a show. And the glass just came right towards me. I mean, it was just totally still the whole time I was sitting up there. And it just came right towards me. And it didn't hit me. It basically came right next to my feet. But instead of being like, oh my God, that just happened, it was like, well, now I got to clean that up. He's going to get mad that I, you know, he's going to think I did it.
Right. Yeah. Amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, it's weird. How people respond to these things, I almost think, is just as interesting as the experience itself. So I completely resonate with the idea of, you know, for some reason, when certain things happen to me, and not a lot has happened to me, I'll be honest, I'm always the envious one. I always kind of wish I was one of those people that had, you know, a lifetime of weird stuff happen, but it just makes mm-hmm. me appreciate the weird stuff that does happen more. But
sure.
rarely have I ever had something happen and it frightened me. If anything, it either annoys me or fascinates me.
Yeah. Yeah. I've other than that, you know, knowing that I had to fix the chandelier suddenly, I thought it was a really wild experience. And there was other things that happened in that house that were, you know, more incidental and stuff. But, The next big one was, this one was actually before this, was at a house that my ex-wife and I lived in before this house. And it was a brand new house. It was built by my uncle. And at the time we just moved into town, and he's like, well, why don't you just rent this and you can stay there? And I'm like, okay. So we did. And it was a brand new house. Nobody had ever lived in it before. And sitting there, I used to work at a factory. So I got home one day, and for some reason it was always tough because no matter whenever I needed to shower, that was exactly the time my ex-wife thought that she needed to do dishes. And so the water pressure in this house was terrible. So as soon as you turn on the tap, that water would go ice cold in the shower. So it was great on this day because I came home from the factory. It was all dirty. I was like, oh my God, I beat her home. So I was like, I'm going to take my shower now. So I locked all the doors and stuff, and I knew she wouldn't be home for a couple hours. So I got in the shower, and the doors were locked to the house, but I also locked the bathroom door. I don't know. There's something about being naked. You feel vulnerable, right? So, I locked the bathroom door too, and I'm in there showering. And we've had activity in this house. This is the house actually that I saw that first orb drift by my nose. And I'm like, should I grab it? No, better not. But the same house, we had footstep sounds and weird things happen there several times. So I'm in the shower and I'm all lathered up and I'm just loving it. I got all the water pressure. I got all the heat and I'm just taking this luxurious shower, and suddenly, boom, the water goes ice cold. Like, oh, damn it. She must have come home. So she must have been doing dishes. And I'm like, ah, oh, and the water's freezing. I'm full of soap, but I quick scrub myself off and wash myself off. And then I reach down and turn off the water in the shower. But I'm still hearing water. I'm like, what the hell's going on? I open the shower curtain, and in the faucet of the sink, which is just on the other side of the toilet from the bathtub where I'm standing getting the shower, the hot water is absolutely blasting.
Oh, that's weird. And
the steam is coming up from it and stuff. And I'm like, ooh. You get that.
That's creepy.
Get the really, yeah, because it was in there with me. And I'm like, oh, no.
Yeah, that would, I think that would push me a little bit into the too close for comfort side.
Yeah, I don't know what it is about clothes, but you just feel like, you're not naked. And something about being naked, you just feel so much more vulnerable. So that was a creepy experience for me. That was probably the one that weirded me out the most, was that one. So, and then there's the time that I actually saw my first UFO, which was really cool.
Oh,
you want to hear about that
one? Oh, yeah, of course I do.
All right. So
as
this
many
story,
weird stories as we can pack in the next 10 minutes, please do.
This story is amazing. So my whole life, obviously, as I've said, I've always had an open mind for the paranormal and the UFOs and stuff. And I was always fascinated by the UFO phenomena. And all the time I would stargaze. I would go out and look in the night. Where I lived in Minnesota through my childhood up into my adult life, there was, very little light pollution. So always had these beautiful night skies and stuff. And I would look up there for hours looking for something because I love the idea that we're not alone, that, there could be these other intelligences out there. And so I would always look and I'd watch all the shows that I could about UFOs and found it absolutely fascinating, but I was always kind of a little disappointed. Like, why don't I ever see anything? Like nothing. I don't see anything other than stars, maybe shooting star once in a while. But these people have these incredible experiences. Why haven't I ever seen anything? So I just always looked for years and years and years and years, never saw anything. But it was one of the first times that I actually came up to this area in North Idaho where I live now. And the preparedness company that I mentioned that I worked for, they used to be located up here in this area. And that's what caused me eventually to move up here. But I was working for them anyway, so I telecommuted. But they had a meeting happening. And so I decided, well, I'm going to, they wanted me to come. And so I flew up here to this area to be a part of the meetings and such for the next planning of the next fiscal year or whatever. And so I came up and the owner of the company had just bought a house and had it all fixed up. It was this beautiful house up in the mountains that was kind of a cabin at first, but he had it, all this work done to it and fixed up. And it was really amazing. And he said, rather than get you a hotel in the town, why don't you just stay up at the cabin? They weren't there yet. They were living in a rented house at the time. And I was like, well, okay. That sounds kind of cool. It'd be nice to be up there in the mountains. And that sounded like a really neat experience. So I was like, okay. So I came up here. We went through the day's meetings and stuff. And then the night came. Now, before that, he had given me a tour of the place. And then he showed me his is night vision binoculars. You know, these generation one night vision binoculars. They're 4-power, so they're not like really powerful binoculars, but I thought, God, that'll be cool, because at night then I can look at the night stars, because I'd always heard that there's more red stars in our galaxy than there are yellow, and most of those red stars we can't see with our naked eye. So I was really excited to do some stargazing with the night vision binoculars. So
I've had a pair of night vision binoculars in my Amazon wish list for a good couple months, but every time I want to buy them, it's always like, oh man, I got something else I really need to get. But
yeah,
I've always wanted one of the, like a pair of those, both for UFO stuff, but also for any possible Bigfoot, because the one thing that I have seen as far as video evidence that isn't the PG film is stuff from thermal and night vision and things like that.
Sure.
So yeah, mm-hmm. But go on.
So I'm up there and I get outside off, and it's out in the mountains. So it's like 20 minutes out of the small town that I'm in. And it's all up in this mountain valley. So basically the situation is his house is basically up a logging road, and it's like early spring. So it's still kind of chilly out. And there are some other cabins up in the area up there, but nobody was moved back in. They were basically summer cabins, hunting cabins, that kind of thing up in this area. So it's only this house. And I was basically the only person for miles and miles and miles. And the house was situated on one side of the valley. Down on the bottom is this creek that would run through next to the logging road. And then there's the other mountainside off to the side. So I'm out there with the night vision binoculars, turn them on, and sure enough, I look at the night sky, and it's amazing. Looking at the night sky with night vision is incredible, folks. You will not recognize constellations, and you will see constellations that are just absolutely phenomenal, like literally geometric shapes and stuff, and clusters of stars that you never knew were out there, and it's just amazing. So if you ever can do it, because that alone was absolutely phenomenal. But I never really had the opportunity to play with night vision binoculars before, or night vision in general. So I was like a kid, I'm looking around, looking at the stars. And then I look at the opposite valley wall and looking at all the forest over there and all the trees. And I'm like, wow, this is really cool. And then I panned over to the side of the mountain that I'm on and looked down the driveway, which was pitch black with my naked eyes, but I could see all the way down, and it's just amazing. And then I pan up to this, I got to look at this ponderosa pine or some conifer of sort. That's right next to his driveway. And I pan up, I get to the top of it, and I keep panning up because I'm gonna look at the stars again. But about 30 foot above this conifer tree, this pine of some sort, is, no kidding, a saucer sitting there.
Wow.
And it's sitting there absolutely quiet above the tree, just sitting there, hovering.
And you had been looking up at the sky for a little bit before you saw this, right?
Right. But I hadn't looked in this direction before. So I'm just out, looking directly above and off in the distance and, in the other direction. So I was kind of covering the whole gambit. And then once I looked above that tree, there it was sitting there. And it's no kidding, a flying saucer, but it's not, where the two pie plates on your traditional flying saucer come together and basically make a point.
Yes.
This wasn't like that. There was a space between those two pie plates. And in that space were these panels, these like rectangular panels that were flashing like a marquee light around, and it had lights on it, and it was flashing. And I'm like, oh my God, there it is. And I'm looking through this generation one night vision right at this thing. And it's about 100 yards roughly away from me. It's like really close. The thing's probably about 20 to 30 feet in diameter, something like that. It's just sitting there, and I'm just amazed. My jaw is on the ground. I'm stunned. All my life I've been looking, and there it was. It was right there. Absolutely silent, absolutely sitting still. And it was amazing. And it's giving off light. And I'm just beside myself, because it's no longer a question. I know these things are real. And I had always had an open mind, as I said. I believe that there must be something to this. But now I was seeing it. So this like epiphany, this paradigm shift is just like boom, and it's exploding on me. And I'm literally beside myself with excitement. And then I'm like, oh my God, I got to see this with my own eyes. So I lower the binoculars and I'm looking straight ahead and nothing's there. There's a tree.
Oh, wow. Okay.
There's the stars behind it, but there's nothing there. I raise the binoculars again. It's there, sitting right where I had seen it before. It hadn't moved. Lower the binoculars, it's gone. Raise them, it's there. Lower, it's gone. And it dawned on me, my God, this thing is cloaked. It's hidden from our native spectrum of light that our eyes can see. It's there, but I can only see it in the night vision. And remember, this thing was giving off light. It was flashing lights. But without the night vision, I couldn't see it at all. It was not there.
That's such a great story, and it brings up the idea about, you know, what is around us that, like, all the time that we can't see, and how that's such a creepy feeling. That's just the idea of that, you know, like, it can be very fascinating, but if you think too much about it, it'll really put one over on you as far as, like, you know, what is around you all the time. But that's an amazing story, and I really envy you, because I've always wanted to see something like that. And, you know, Maryland it's a small state, and most of it, unless you go out to the west, towards West Virginia and Pittsburgh, it's all cities, it's all towns, it's all neighborhoods. So the light pollution, you can't escape it.
Sure.
And so I remember, you know, working, I've been a security guard now for going on 4 years, and I'm always outside. So at night I would just sit outside on the roof of my car, staring at the sky, just waiting, hoping to see something. And, you know, oh, here it is. No, it's a plane. Oh, here it is. Oh, no, that's a helicopter. All right. Well, you know, so I'm very envious of you, and but that's such a cool story. Like, just the whole atmosphere of it is a really interesting concept.
Yeah, it was. And that's what I thought. It's like, oh my God, they can be anywhere and we wouldn't know it. They could be anytime, and they can hide. And then I was like, oh my God, this is unreal. And I'm watching and I'm thinking about it. And then it dawns on me that I'm about the only thing going on in this whole valley. Like, I'm the only person here. And they're up there. So chances are they're up there looking at me.
Yeah, they're the ones, and you know, they're looking at you the way you're looking at them.
Right. Well, I'm sure they've probably seen people before, but I didn't. It was like, wait a minute. Oh, I don't need this to be any more real than it is right now. So, good. I just shut off everything and went inside and locked the doors, because it was like, oh, I just needed to see that. Like, that was important to me. But if that thing would have landed, I probably would have stroked out or something.
Oh, yeah. We're such fragile creatures when it comes to what we can handle psychologically. That's such a cool story, and I probably would have done the same thing. We're almost out of time, but before we go, I just wanted to ask you, what has been either one of your favorite guests that you've had on the portal, or one of the your favorite episodes or stories that you've had the joy of getting on the show?
Well, I don't know that there's any one story that I like more than others. I think that any of the stories that people have shared on the show have been amazing. And so I think it would be an injustice to say one story was better than any other, because I think they're all phenomenal and they all demonstrate this magical wonder that is going on around us. But as far as guests go, I mean, of course it's easy to think, well, I really loved having Wes on the show when we did a podcast together, and I loved, you know, I love talking to Bobo, and I love talking to Lon Strickler, and so many of the big names that, you know, that we've had on the show. And I've been very fortunate to have an opportunity to interview. But honest to God, anybody that's come on the show ever has been my favorite, because it's for the bigger names, it's, you know, it's kind of expected. They're going to go on shows and they're going to talk about what they're doing, and, you know, because they want to promote what they're up to. And of course they bring a lot to the table as far as knowledge and insights and ideas and stuff. But I'm also equally impressed by just the regular people that are stepping forward and saying, look, I saw this. This is what I experienced, because that's brave. That's exposing themselves. And they have to confront what they've experienced and bring it to a very public forum. And I think that's an incredible act of bravery and courage. And it's always a distinct and incredible honor that they would do that on my show. You know, I'm just blown away by that. And so I don't, I don't know if that sounds like a cop out, and I don't mean it to, but
it's a good answer because it shows, you know, how appreciative you are of just anyone who comes on the show and how, you know, in tune you are with the concept of, you know, someone seeing this and being able to share it on a public forum like The Portal or this show or any of the other podcasts that have the same function. So no, I like your answer.
Okay.
One of the recent episodes you did on, I can't remember her name, but The Green Witch, I thought that was a fascinating episode. I couldn't stop listening to that. That was great.
Yeah, she was fantastic. I mean, and so that's what I love, though, is because everybody that comes on the show brings something new. And at the end of the day, this is my quest, is to understand or try to understand. And it's probably a really lofty goal, but everybody brings a new puzzle piece to my picture. And something they saw, some way that they observed it that nobody ever had before, or some word that they will use to describe it that really connects, you know, the questions I have in my head. So I'm just thrilled. I feel very blessed to be able to do the show and to have people like it and want to take part in it. That to me is amazing.
And I would feel the same way, and that's why I'm excited for my journey, and I'm just so happy that you came on and shared this with me and all your wisdom and all your experiences. It's been a real pleasure to have you on and listen to all this, and I can't wait to have you back.
Oh, yeah, brother, just let me know. I'll come on anytime, man. Awesome. It's been fun.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate that, and it has been fun. So
hey, brother.
Thank you so much, and you have a great night.
You as well.
Bye. And that was Brent Thomas, wonderful, wonderful guest and host of the Paranormal Portal. He will be back on for different episodes. I hope to be on his show as well, probably bring him on for a roundtable type show. And that's it for this episode. Just want to note that the Patreon is up. I will be putting more episodes and merchandise for the different tiers and sort of explaining that in the coming episodes. So look out for that, the link for that, as well as the link for Paranormal Portal, both the YouTube and the website, and all of his social media will be in the show notes. And we will see you again next time.